A few years ago, I went to New York City with my brother and his wife. We went to watch Hamilton. The three of us had been fans of the musical for a while, and my brother decided to get his wife tickets as a birthday present. Since he's a very kind man, he also bought me a ticket as a birthday present, and we had a great time in New York City. In fact, we still get each other goofy gag gifts every year based on various parts of that trip. For those of you who don't know, Hamilton ends with the song "Who Lives, Who Dies, Who Tells Your Story," which tells the story of what Eliza Hamilton, Alexander's wife, did after his death. Things like telling the story of Alexander Hamilton, helping to fund the Washington Monument, and establishing the first private orphanage in New York City. Seeing it live, I had the same impression I did on my third or fourth listen of the album. Lin-Manuel Miranda got it wrong. He wrote about the wrong Hamilton. Alexander is interesting enough, sure, but Eliza Hamilton did all these cool things. He should have made the whole musical about her. I mean, I get why he didn't. A lot of the records about Eliza were pretty famously burned. And even if he did make the musical about Eliza, there'd be some idiot like me saying he should have made it about Alexander. You can't please everybody. But since I have an outlet, I've decided to correct a similar issue. I sat in a whole lot of English literature classes throughout the years, and when it came time to cover the era of the Romantic poets, the focus tended to be on Percy Shelley, poetic genius. And if it wasn't, the focus would be on Lord Byron and his recreational swimming. One writer who often got left as a footnote was Percy Shelley's wife, Mary Shelley. She was usually thrown in as an afterthought, with some acknowledgement that she wrote Frankenstein, and that was usually the extent of it. Not here. Not if I have anything to say about it. Mary Shelley, born Mary Godwin, is our focus today, and by the end of this, I hope I can convince you I made the right choice of subject. If not, there's always more episodes to come. Now, if you've listened to my last episode on John Milton, you may remember that I started it by talking about John Milton's father. I gave a man nearly forgotten by history a little spotlight. This isn't really possible with Mary Shelley. Her father is William Godwin, a well-known philosopher, publisher, and anarchist. Her mother was Mary Wollstonecraft, a well-known philosopher, author, and advocate for women's rights. I can't really shine a spotlight on them, as history has already provided one. I still want to start things off talking about a parent, though. Now, I will almost certainly talk about William Godwin a few times throughout this, as he has a role to play in various parts of Mary Shelley's life. Mary Wollstonecraft, however, lacks a certain physical presence in the life of Mary Shelley. That's because Mary Shelley was born on August 30th, 1797. Her mother, Mary Wollstonecraft, died a few weeks later on September 10th, 1797. Due to an infection caused by childbirth. Because she won't be there physically throughout Mary's life, we're going to do a little dive on Mary Wollstonecraft. However, I'm going to try to keep it pretty quick, as Mary Wollstonecraft's life and work honestly deserve their own episode. Mary Wollstonecraft was born in 1759. She grew up in an abusive household under her consistently drunk and violent father. While the Wollstonecrafts were relatively wealthy at the time of Mary's birth, her father would lose vast amounts of money on poor investments, which only intensified his drunkenness and violent attitude. She would eventually leave home, finding work as a lady's companion. She founded a school, but ultimately had to close it due to her leaving to help a friend. She later found work as a governess. For those of you who don't know what a governess is, think Mary Poppins, or Maria from The Sound of Music. As an educator, her pupils found her inspiring. One of her pupils, future author Margaret King, especially enjoyed her teaching. After a year of governessing, she decided to quit and join the literary world. She was assisted by publisher Joseph Johnson, one of the most influential publishers of the late 1700s and early 1800s. Joseph supported Mary by giving her work as a translator and novel reviewer for his periodical called Analytical Review. Joseph also regularly hosted dinners with prominent thinkers. At one of these dinners, Mary met Thomas Paine of Common Sense fame and her future husband, William Godwin. Godwin and Wollstonecraft's first meeting was spent arguing over a variety of topics, which Godwin was very disappointed in. He had come to listen to Thomas Paine, not Mary Wollstonecraft. Other notable attendees of these dinners were Erasmus Darwin, grandfather of Charles Darwin, Joseph Priestley, the man often credited with discovering oxygen, and Henry Fuseli. Henry Fuseli was an artist who Mary Wollstonecraft quickly fell in love with. All accounts regard this as very passionate, but also very platonic. Mary just wanted to keep Henry, who she considered a genius, in her life. So much so that she proposed that she would move in with him. This idea was quickly shot down. Not by Henry, but by Henry's wife, Sophia, who wasn't thrilled with the idea of another woman moving into her home. Fun fact, Henry Fuseli would later attempt to create a John Milton gallery, painting over 40 pieces related to John Milton. The venture would be a complete financial failure for Fuseli. Around this time, Mary wrote her two most famous works, A Vindication of the Rights of Men, defending the French Revolution, and A Vindication of the Rights of Woman. A Vindication of the Rights of Woman makes her a household name among notable intellectuals of the time. In it, she argues, among other things, that women and men are equal in the eyes of God, and women should receive education, not just in things like housekeeping, but in all the things that men received education in. This was a pretty radical thought, as there were prevailing attitudes at the time that women were simply incapable of rational thought. Mary, however, believed that educating women at the same level as men would make women better wives and better mothers, as well as make them better equipped to contribute to society. She attributes the lack of education for women to be caused by, among other things, men who simply didn't want to see women educated. She writes, "One cause of this barren blooming I attribute to a false system of education, gathered from the books written on this subject by men who, considering females rather as women than human creatures, have been more anxious to make them alluring mistresses than affectionate wives and rational mothers." She would go on to write, "My own sex, I hope, will excuse me if I treat them like rational creatures, instead of flattering their fascinating graces and viewing them as if they were in a state of perpetual childhood, unable to stand alone. I earnestly wish to point out in what true dignity and human happiness consists. I wish to persuade women to endeavor to acquire strength, both of mind and body, and to convince them that the soft phrases, susceptibility of heart, delicacy of sentiment, and refinement of taste, are almost synonymous with epithets of weakness, and that those beings who are only the objects of pity and that kind of love which has been termed its sister will soon become objects of contempt." Fascinated by the French Revolution and embarrassed by her failed platonic grasp for Henry Fuseli, Mary left for France in 1792. While there, she fell in love with the American, Gilbert Imlay. This was not a platonic love, as they began being quite physical, despite the fact that they weren't married. But don't tell anyone they're not married, okay? Because Gilbert Imlay claimed they were married. This marriage made her an American citizen, which is likely the only reason she wasn't guillotined during the Reign of Terror. The French Revolution had taken a dark and bloody turn, and Mary Wollstonecraft was not quite as fascinated anymore, especially since all her French friends kept losing their heads. Mary and Gilbert soon had proof of their physical activities, as Mary became pregnant with her first daughter, Fanny Imlay. Mary would write about the French Revolution in An Historical and Moral View of the French Revolution, which has come to light more recently as a pretty solid account of the French Revolution, as Mary was one of the few contemporary writers who wrote about the revolution being caused by social, economic, and political conditions, instead of some kind of mass hysteria overtaking the French people. After the birth of their daughter, Gilbert left France and Mary. Mary would return to London in 1795 to reunite with Imlay, but he rejected her, causing her to attempt suicide by laudanum. She tried to win Imlay back one last time by attempting to track down a Norwegian captain who had stolen silver from Imlay. In fact, she traveled all throughout Scandinavia trying to find this man. Her travels were eventually published in a travelogue. When she returned, she realized her relationship with Imlay was over and attempted suicide again, this time jumping into the River Thames, only to be saved by a stranger. Eventually, she would return to her old world of literature and begin a courtship with William Godwin. Godwin had read her travelogue and had said, "If ever there was a book calculated to make a man in love with its author, this appears to me to be the book. She speaks of her sorrows in a way that fills us with melancholy and dissolves us in tenderness, at the same time that she displays a genius which commands all our admiration." Mary soon became pregnant again, and William decided to marry her to make the child legitimate. This, however, revealed the truth about her marriage to Gilbert Imlay. Both Mary and William suffered blows to their reputation, since the marriage being fake meant Mary had had a daughter out of wedlock, which was a big no-no at the time. As I already said, Mary would die of infection after giving birth to Mary Godwin. William Godwin was racked in grief, later saying in a letter that, "I firmly believe there does not exist her equal in the world. I know from experience we were formed to make each other happy. I have not the least expectation that I can now ever know happiness again." Following her death, Godwin poured himself into a biography of her called Memoirs of the Author of a Vindication of the Rights of Woman. He was open and honest about her life, including the illegitimate child, the suicide attempts, and her more radical opinions. He did this, by all accounts, out of love and respect for his wife. He fully believed that if people knew about this wonderful woman, they would accept her, regardless of the scandalous nature of her life. His intentions may have been pure, but he was wrong. This biography more or less destroyed Mary Wollstonecraft's reputation for over a century. Her work was still read and occasionally published in the decades after her death, but her personal reputation would not recover until much, much later. If you're interested in learning more about Mary Wollstonecraft, and Mary Shelley for that matter, I highly recommend the dual biography, Romantic Outlaws, The Extraordinary Lives of Mary Wollstonecraft and Mary Shelley, by Charlotte Gordon. All right, our dive is over. We now go from one Mary to another. When we left off, the future Mary Shelley was born Mary Godwin on August 30th, 1797. She and her sister, Fanny Imlay, were both raised by William Godwin. Throughout Mary Godwin's life, William Godwin would find himself constantly struggling with debt. He also felt his two daughters could use a mother figure in their life, so he remarried. He married Mary Jane Claremont in 1801, probably because he felt there weren't enough Marys in this story yet. Mary Claremont had two children of her own, Claire and Charles. The couple of William and Mary would also have a son together, William Godwin the Younger. As a quick host note here, I will be using Mary Jane Claremont's maiden name through a lot of this, even though she took William Godwin's name when they married. This is to try and keep the various Marys straight in your mind. Just to be clear, Mary Shelley, her stepmother Mary Claremont, and her biological mother, Mary Wollstonecraft, were all called Mary Godwin at various points in their life. So when I say Mary Godwin, I'm talking about Mary Shelley before she gets married. Okay? William's friends didn't like Mary Claremont very much, and Mary Godwin and Fanny Imlay didn't always have kind things to say about their stepmother, probably due to her often giving preferential treatment to her own children. But, by all accounts, William and Mary were happily married. William wasn't exactly one to care much about other people's opinions of his spouses. William and Mary Claremont started M.J. Godwin, which was a publishing firm that published books, maps, and games. Unfortunately, this venture would not be the solution to William's money problems. Quite the opposite. He had to continually borrow money to keep it open. But enough about financial troubles for now. Let's talk about education. Mary Wollstonecraft once argued that women should be educated in all things. And while William didn't follow her philosophy exactly, he did give Mary Godwin a solid education. He tutored her himself, as well as hiring a governess and a tutor. He gave her full access to his library, including his own manuscripts on Roman and Greek history, as well as the complete works of her mother, Mary Wollstonecraft. He would also take educational field trips with his children. While this education was not exactly traditional, it came with some perks that traditional education doesn't. William Godwin was a very notable intellectual. As such, other notable intellectuals often came to visit and talk a while. Godwin would often let his daughters sit in on these talks, and would even encourage them to participate. People like the poet Samuel Taylor Coleridge, of the Rime of the Ancient Mariner fame, and former American Vice President Aaron Burr would often come to visit. Wait, the Hamilton thing was just for the intro. What's Aaron Burr doing here? Well, he was a big fan of Mary Wollstonecraft. In fact, he had a portrait of Mary Wollstonecraft over his mantle, and had long argued for women's education, something Mary Wollstonecraft was very passionate about. He visited Godwin mainly to meet and get to know the daughters of the woman he had admired. In 1812, Mary Godwin was sent to stay with the family of radical thinker William Baxter. Now the word radical here probably needs a quick explanation. I'm not using it to describe him as out there. I'm also not using it like surfer lingo. He's not radical, dude. Radicalism was a political ideology of the time. It was very progressive and liberal and was inspired by ideas that came out in the French Revolution. If you want more information than that, you're going to have to find someone who's more knowledgeable about politics. That's not me. I'm just here to tell you about the storytellers. Mary Godwin's stay with William Baxter was very enjoyable. She especially enjoyed the friendship of his four daughters. In fact, Mary would return in 1813 for another 10 months. While Mary is away with the Baxters, I'd like to take a moment to talk about William Godwin's work. I've talked before about people admiring William Godwin, and that's probably going to continue, but why? What did he write? Well, he wrote a lot of things that you've likely never heard of. His two most notable novels are Things as They Are, or The Adventures of Caleb Williams, as well as Saint Leon. In terms of nonfiction, I already said he wrote a biography of Mary Wollstonecraft, but he was much more famous for Inquiry Concerning Political Justice and Its Influence on Morals and Happiness, which is usually just shortened to Political Justice. Political justice is what really made his name known. In the long-distant future of 1834, which we're not at yet in our little story, but bear with me, William Godwin will write Lives of the Necromancers, or an account of the most eminent persons in successive ages who have claimed for themselves, or to whom has been imputed by others, the exercise of magical powers. And no, I don't know why every book from this period thinks its title has to be an entire essay. Now, I could talk to you about how good William Godwin's writing was, but why would you care what I had to say about it? Let's ask someone whose opinion probably carries more weight. Edgar Allan Poe, a man who needs no introduction. This is the start of his review of Lives of the Necromancers. The name of the author of Caleb Williams and of Saint Leon is, with us, a word of weight, and one which we consider a guarantee for the excellence of any composition to which it may be affixed. There is, about all the writings of Godwin, one peculiarity which we are not sure that we have ever seen pointed out for observation, but which, nevertheless, is his chief idiosyncrasy, setting him peculiarly apart from all other literati of his day. We allude to an air of mature thought, of deliberate premeditation pervading, in a remarkable degree, even his most commonplace observations. He never uses a hurried expression, or hazards either an ambiguous phrase or a premature opinion. His style, therefore, is highly artificial, but the extreme finish and proportion always observable about it render this artificiality, which in less able hands would be wearisome, in him a grace inestimable. We are never tired of his terse, nervous, and sonorous periods, for their terseness, their energy, and even their melody are made, in all cases, subservient to the sense with which they are invariably fraught. No English writer with whom we have any acquaintance, with the single exception of Coleridge, has a fuller appreciation of the value of words, and none is more nicely discriminative between closely approximating meanings. Poe later concludes, "The pen which wrote Caleb Williams should never for a moment be idle." Back in 1812-ish, a poet and philosopher named Percy Bysshe Shelley began writing to William Godwin. He was a fan of both William and Mary Wollstonecraft. Percy wrote to Godwin, asking him if Fanny Imlay, Mary Wollstonecraft's first daughter, could come live with him and his wife. An arrangement, you might remember, Mary Wollstonecraft wanted for herself with Henry Fuseli. William Godwin, who had never actually met Percy Shelley, naturally declined. So Percy began visiting William Godwin. William Godwin initially liked Percy, largely because Percy kept promising to bail William out of debt using his family's money. The Shelleys were quite rich. However, Percy Shelley didn't get along with his family. He fought regularly with his father, which made it hard to get money from him. He also fought regularly with his wife, Harriet Westbrook, which caused him to spend more and more time with the Godwins. By 1814, he was spending a lot of time with the Godwins. All three of Godwin's daughters took a liking to Percy. In fact, Mary, Fanny, and Claire would all be linked romantically to Percy at various points in their lives. Around this time, Mary and Percy began meeting secretly at St. Pancras Old Church, not to be confused with St. Pancras New Church. Mary Wollstonecraft was buried there, and the two would often meet at her grave. At the time, Mary Shelley was 16, Percy was 21. By June of that year, Percy confessed his love for Mary, who returned it in full. They soon began a very passionate affair, which they both told William Godwin about. Now, I want you to put yourself in William Godwin's shoes for a moment. A young man writes to you, asking to take one of your daughters to live with him and his wife. After turning him down, he shows up and starts promising you he can pay off your debts, despite never actually doing it. Then a year or two later, he admits he's passionately in love with one of your other daughters while still being married. What would you do? If you said, "Do everything you can do to break up this relationship," congratulations, you and William Godwin think alike. He was furious and tried to separate the two whenever he could. William's negative reaction surprised Mary, who, other than being 16 and naive, viewed Percy Shelley as a genius and the embodiment of William Godwin's own ideas. In fact, William had once argued against the very idea of marriage as a concept. Why would he care that Percy was married? Also around this time, William Godwin learns that Percy Shelley is not going to be able to pay off William's debt, due to him being largely cut off by his father. So he bans Percy from the house. A month later, Mary Godwin and Percy Shelley eloped and took Claire Claremont with them as they headed for France. Mary Jane Claremont follows them all the way to Calais. She begs all three to go home. When that fails, she asks that they at least send Claire home. She is unsuccessful on all fronts and returns home herself, while Mary, Percy, and Claire continue on through war-torn France. Remember, this is just a few months after the War of the Sixth Coalition, where Napoleon was defeated and exiled. The first time. The Napoleonic Wars had been raging on and off since 1803. Prior to that was the French Revolution and the Reign of Terror, which involved a lot of guillotining and chaos. France was pretty ravaged by this point in 1814. As the trio traveled, they read and they wrote. Mary and Percy kept a joint journal and wrote their own works as well. Pretty quickly into this journey, however, the trio ran out of money and returned home, about 6 weeks after leaving. Upon returning to England, Mary encounters some issues she had not foreseen. First of all, at some point in the trip, she got pregnant. Then her father, William Godwin, wanted absolutely nothing to do with her when they returned. So the three of them had to get lodgings elsewhere. Unfortunately, Percy had to pretty consistently leave home to dodge various creditors that wanted back money they had lent him. Given that Mary was young, pregnant, and often sick, she was not exactly enjoying the fact that her lover had to constantly leave her. To pile on to Mary's misery, in late 1814, Charles Bysshe Shelley was born to Percy Shelley and his wife, Harriet Westbrook. So now, she had to see how happy her lover was with his new son. The only comfort Mary seemed to find at the time was with the visits of Percy's friend, Thomas Jefferson Hogg, who, despite being initially disliked, would grow into one of her closest friends. And for those of you who are interested in weird law cases, this is not the same Thomas Hogg who was charged with bestiality in the New Haven colony after pigs were born that bared a resemblance to him. Our Thomas Hogg was a lawyer and a writer. Whether or not he became a lawyer to avoid his namesake's fate, or if he even knew about him, we don't know. It's around this time we should probably talk about how open Mary Godwin and Percy Shelley's relationship was. Both Mary and Percy believed in the idea of free love, and pretty clearly didn't respect the idea of a monogamous relationship. Percy is still married to Harriet at this time, after all. While the trio lived together, Percy Shelley and Claire Claremont were almost certainly romantically and physically entwined. Percy also tried to hook up Mary Godwin with Thomas Hogg. Despite some apparent interest from both sides, it isn't believed it ever got beyond the occasional flirtation. We'll see this throughout their relationship, by the way. Both believe in the idea of free love in principle, but only Percy ever seems to act on it. Mary, it seems, really only had eyes for Percy. Around this time, two deaths change things significantly for Mary and Percy. The first death is of Percy's grandfather, Sir Bysshe Shelley. He died and left a sizable estate. The legal resolution of this matter would take about a year, but this death would help alleviate some of the financial stress they were under. In February 1815, Mary Godwin gives birth to a premature baby girl. The second death is of this child, who died a few days after being born. This death would greatly affect Mary, who would regularly see visions of her dead child. By the summer of 1815, however, Mary was in better spirits, largely because she had conceived again. It's worth noting here that most of what we know about Mary Shelley's life is from her own journals. Between the summer of 1815 and July of 1816, we do not have a journal, so very little is known, other than Mary gave birth on the 24th of January, 1816, to William Shelley, named after William Godwin. We also know that at some point around here, Claire Claremont begins an affair with Lord Byron. If you needed proof, proof was soon provided as Claire was pregnant with Byron's baby. So, in May of 1816, Mary Godwin, now calling herself Mrs. Shelley, Percy Shelley, their son William, and Claire Claremont all traveled to Geneva to spend the summer with Lord Byron. This party arrived on the 14th and rented a building on the lakefront of Lake Geneva. Lord Byron, along with his physician and fellow writer, John William Polidori, arrived and rented another place by the lake called Villa Diodati. For those of you who tuned in for the episode on John Milton, you may recognize the name Diodati. Charles Diodati was John Milton's best friend, and as far as we can tell, the Diodatis that owned this villa were related in some way to Charles. As a further Milton connection, there was a plaque there that said Milton had visited the villa in 1638 during his trip through Europe. Historians tend to doubt this, especially since the villa wasn't even built until 1710, a few decades after Milton's death. The group spent their time writing, talking, and occasionally sailing on the lake. There likely would have been more sailing, but this was 1816, commonly referred to as the Year Without a Summer. It was named the Year Without a Summer due to the temperatures in Europe that summer being the coldest on record, as well as increased cloud cover and rain. Scientists today attribute this to the eruption of Mount Tambora. In 1815, Mount Tambora, located in modern-day Indonesia, had a VEI-7 magnitude volcanic eruption. I don't know too much about volcanoes, but a quick Google search tells me that VEI-7 is the highest level of eruptions before you get into super eruptions, which come with tights and a cape and haven't been seen in over 20,000 years. To give you an idea of how common these are, the most recent VEI-7 eruption was Mount Tambora in 1815. Prior to that, 1257, again in Indonesia. That's some tough luck there for the Indonesians. The 1815 eruption caused the Year Without a Summer, which was a disaster throughout the world due to crop failures caused by the abnormal weather patterns. It's always the things that break our normal cycles that cause the most disruptions. Because they couldn't go out and enjoy the lake, the group of Mary, Percy, Byron, John Polidori, and Claire spent a large amount of time indoors, writing, reading each other ghost stories from the book Phantasmagoriana, which was a French translation of German ghost stories, and enjoying each other's company. Now, the way this podcast works is that I tell you about the events, right? Well, we're going to do the next part a little differently. A very important event will occur at the lake house during this trip, and I think Mary deserves to tell you about it in her own words. So I'm going to read you about 9 paragraphs of something Mary wrote in 1831 about her time in the lake house. I'll interrupt a few times to provide you the necessary context, but I think it's best heard straight from the storyteller's mouth. All right? Okay, here we go. "We will each write a ghost story," said Lord Byron, and his proposition was acceded to. There were 4 of us. The noble author began a tale, a fragment of which he printed at the end of his poem of Mazeppa. Shelley, more apt to embody ideas and sentiments in the radiance of brilliant imagery and in the music of the most melodious verse that adorns our language than to invent the machinery of a story, commenced one founded on the experiences of his early life. Poor Polidori had some terrible idea about a skull-headed lady who was so punished for peeping through a keyhole, what to see, I forget, something very shocking and wrong, of course. But when she was reduced to a worse condition than the renowned Tom of Coventry, he did not know what to do with her, and was obliged to dispatch her to the tomb of the Capulets, the only place for which she was fitted. The illustrious poets also, annoyed by the platitude of prose, speedily relinquished this uncongenial task. Okay, first context interruption. Mary says there were four of them. Why Claire isn't included in this, I don't know. Possibly because she didn't write anything, but I'm not sure. The fragment, Byron wrote, is called Fragment of a Novel. It is most notable for being the inspiration for The Vampire, spelt with a Y, by John Polidori in 1819. The Fragment and The Vampire are credited as being the first stories that made vampires less Nosferatu-style monsters and more the functioning members of society we now associate with them. I am not aware of Percy Shelley's or John Polidori's stories being known about today. The renowned Tom of Coventry, she mentions, is from a version of the legend of Lady Godiva. You may have heard the story of Lady Godiva riding naked through the streets. In later retellings of the story, there was one villager who watched her as she rode, named Tom, who was blinded for his voyeurism. This Tom is where we get Peeping Tom from. Okay, back to Mary. I busied myself to think of a story to rival those which had excited us to this task, one which would speak to the mysterious fears of our nature and awaken thrilling horror, one to make the reader dread to look round, to curdle the blood and quicken the beatings of the heart. If I did not accomplish these things, my ghost story would be unworthy of its name. I thought and pondered vainly. I felt that blank incapability of invention, which is the greatest misery of authorship, when dull nothing replies to our anxious invocations. Have you thought of a story? I was asked each morning, and each morning I was forced to reply with a mortifying negative. Everything must have a beginning, to speak in Sancian phrase, and that beginning must be linked to something that went before. The Hindus give the world an elephant to support it, but they make the elephant stand upon a tortoise. Invention, it must be humbly admitted, does not consist in creating out of void, but out of chaos. The materials must, in the first place, be afforded. It can give form to dark, shapeless substances, but cannot bring into being the substance itself. In all matters of discovery and invention, even of those that appertain to the imagination, we are continually reminded of the story of Columbus and his egg. Invention consists in the capacity of seizing on the capabilities of a subject, and in the power of molding and fashioning ideas suggested to it. All right, it's me again. Context break. Sancian phrase is a reference to the character of Sancho Panza from Don Quixote. The world being on the back of elephants is in fact a known Hindu myth. The world being on the back of a turtle is actually not Hindu specific, but it certainly appears in Hindu mythology. It also appears in some Chinese and Native American myths. It also, of course, appears in Terry Pratchett's Discworld series. Columbus and his egg refers to an old apocryphal story about Christopher Columbus. For those of you who don't know, apocryphal is just a fancy way of saying it probably didn't happen. And if it did, it probably didn't happen like that. And if it did, it probably didn't happen to that person. The story is that while at dinner, Columbus is basically told that his trip to America wasn't that important, because sooner or later, someone would have done it. He just happened to be the first one to do it. He then challenges the entire group to stand an egg on its end. The whole group fails and gives up. Columbus then takes the egg and hits it against the table to make it flat enough to stand. The moral of the story being, just because you know how something was done after it's already been done, it doesn't mean you could have done it the first time. Basically, creativity is good and important. Also, and this is not really context, but Mary's writing here really reminds me of Paradise Lost. All the talk of forming things out of chaos and dark, shapeless substances. Very Milton-esque. All right, back to Mary. Many and long were the conversations between Lord Byron and Shelley, to which I was a devout but nearly silent listener. During one of these, various philosophical doctrines were discussed, and among others, the nature of the principle of life, and whether there was any probability of its ever being discovered and communicated. They talked of the experiments of Dr. Darwin. I speak not of what the doctor really did, or said that he did, but as more to my purpose of what was then spoken of as having been done by him, who preserved a piece of vermicelli in a glass case, till by some extraordinary means it began to move with voluntary motion. Not thus, after all, would life be given. Perhaps a corpse would be reanimated. Galvanism had given token of such things. Perhaps the component parts of a creature might be manufactured, brought together, and endued with vital warmth. Context time again. Dr. Darwin is Erasmus Darwin, noted scientist, dinner guest of Joseph Johnson, and grandfather of Charles Darwin. She writes about a piece of vermicelli, which is a type of pasta. Scholars are pretty sure she meant vorticella, which is a microscopic creature. Galvanism was the idea that electricity was the foundation of life. This idea came about when people realized that if you electrocuted dead things, they moved. This led to people believing that life and electricity were somehow linked. Now, you may be tempted to mock the science of 200 years ago as ridiculous, but think about this. In just about every medical TV show, patients that flatline are shocked back to life using magic electricity paddles, which, for the record, is not possible. Defibrillators don't do anything for a flatlining patient. But until someone told me that defibrillators can only shock a heart back into rhythm, not restart a stopped heart, I, like most people, just assumed that's how they worked. So be careful before you mock the idea of electricity being linked to life. Also, you've now learned a little about volcanoes and defibrillators, exactly what you'd expect from a podcast about authors. Back to you, Mary. Night waned upon this talk, and even the witching hour had gone by before we retired to rest. When I placed my head on my pillow, I did not sleep, nor could I be said to think. My imagination, unbidden, possessed, and guided me, gifting the successive images that arose in my mind with a vividness far beyond the usual bounds of reverie. I saw, with shut eyes, but acute mental vision. I saw the pale student of unhallowed arts kneeling beside the thing he had put together. I saw the hideous phantasm of a man stretched out, and then, on the workings of some powerful engine, show signs of life and stir with an uneasy, half-vital motion. Frightful must it be, for supremely frightful would be the effect on any human endeavor to mock the stupendous mechanism of the creator of the world. Success would terrify the artist. He would rush away from his odious handiwork, horror-stricken. He would hope that, left to itself, the slight spark of life which he had communicated would fade, that this thing, which had received such imperfect animation, would subside into dead matter, and he might sleep in the belief that the silence of the grave would quench forever the transient existence of the hideous corpse which he had looked upon as the cradle of life. He sleeps. But he is awakened. He opens his eyes. Behold, the horrid thing stands at his bedside, opening his curtains and looking on him with yellow, watery, but speculative eyes. I opened mine in terror. The idea so possessed my mind that a thrill of fear ran through me, and I wished to exchange the ghastly image of my fancy for the realities around. I see them still. The very room, the dark parquet, the closed shutters with the moonlight struggling through, and the sense I had that the glassy lake and high white Alps were beyond. I could not so easily get rid of my hideous phantom. Still, it haunted me. I must try to think of something else. I recurred to my ghost story,
My tiresome, unlucky ghost story. Oh, if I could only contrive one which would frighten my reader as I myself had been frightened that night. Swift as light and as cheering was the idea that broke in upon me. I have found it. What terrified me will terrify others, and I need only describe the specter which had haunted my midnight pillow. On the morrow, I announced that I had thought of a story. I began that day with the words, "It was on a dreary night of November," making only a transcript of the grim terrors of my waking dream. At first I thought but of a few pages, of a short tale, but Shelley urged me to develop the idea at greater length. I certainly did not owe the suggestion of one incident, nor scarcely of one train of feeling to my husband, and yet, but for his incitement, it would never have taken the form in which it was presented to the world. From this declaration I must accept the preface. As far as I can recollect, it was entirely written by him. And now, once again, I bid my hideous progeny go forth and prosper. I have an affection for it was the offspring of happy days, when death and grief were but words, which found no true echo in my heart. Its several pages speak of many a walk, many a drive, and many a conversation when I was not alone, and my companion was one whom, in this world, I shall never see more. But this is for myself. My readers have nothing to do with these associations. I'll offer one final bit of context. Her hideous progeny, this dream Mary fanned into a flame, became Frankenstein, or the modern Prometheus. The paragraphs I've been quoting are from her introduction to Frankenstein.
In my first draft of this podcast, I didn't even explain the plot of Frankenstein because I was so sure you'd all know what it was. I still think that, for the record, but I'll give you a quick synopsis just in case. In Frankenstein, Victor Frankenstein is a scientist. After the death of his mother, he succeeds in creating new life by putting together pieces of dead people. Rather than be excited, he is horrified by his creation, which leaves. After a while, his creation returns and demands that Victor creates a bride for him. If Victor refuses, his creation says it will kill his friends and family. Victor starts to make a bride, then stops, and destroys his work due to his fear that his creations would be too evil and dangerous. His creation kills Victor's brother, Victor's friends, and Victor's bride. Eventually, Victor and his creation head to Russia, where Victor dies and his creation heads north, determined to burn himself on a funeral pyre. Now, there's a lot to unpack in Frankenstein, so let's start with the name. Some people believe Mary got the name Frankenstein from Frankenstein Castle, a castle in Germany where a famous alchemist once lived. However, the name Frankenstein is basically just Rock of the Franks. The Franks were a pretty large Germanic tribe, and castles were often built on rocks. So Frankenstein is not considered a name that's necessarily unique to that specific castle. The second part of the name, the modern-day Prometheus, refers to Prometheus. Prometheus, apart from being a 2012 film in the Alien franchise, is the Greek god of fire and forethought. His most famous act was stealing fire from Olympus and giving it to humans. He took something from the gods and gave it to humans. Similar to how Victor Frankenstein took the act of creating a life from the gods and gave it to humans. The name of Victor Frankenstein's creation is often debated. Frankenstein's creation is often just called Frankenstein. Now, undoubtedly, you've heard some variation of Frankenstein is the doctor, not the monster, or the next level, knowledge is knowing that Frankenstein is not the monster, wisdom is knowing that Frankenstein is the monster. Both are relatively accurate, though I'd argue that Frankenstein and his creation are both monsters, so you really can't go wrong. Now, there was a trend a little while back where people claimed that the creation's name was actually Adam. This, I think, is caused by a misinterpretation of a line from Frankenstein, where the creature says, "I ought to be thy Adam." This is in reference to the biblical Adam, who was the first human. Instead of giving his name, the creation is identifying that he is the first of his kind, and that Victor should make at least one more. Remember, Adam was lonely, so God made Eve. Frankenstein's creation was lonely and wanted a bride. This namelessness is intentional. In fact, there's even a story about Mary going to see a performance in 1823 based on Frankenstein, where Thomas Cook played the creation. The playbill credits him with just a bunch of dashes, which reportedly amused Mary, who later wrote in a letter that this nameless mode of naming the unnameable is rather good. This would not be the only link Frankenstein has to the theater. The popularity of Frankenstein was largely boosted by theatrical performances. Even today, Frankenstein is better known as a universal monster than as a character from a book. Moving on from names, let's talk some differences between how you probably see Frankenstein's creation in your mind's eye and how Mary actually described him. You probably think of him as green or gray. Mary describes his skin as yellow. He was made green by Universal, who thought that green showed up better on screen. He was later portrayed as gray in certain projects to avoid copyright issues with Universal. You may picture Frankenstein with scars all over his body from being stitched together. Mary never describes the creation as having scars, only describing his skin as being very thin and almost see-through. You also probably picture the two bolts coming out of his neck. The bolts are usually said to be there to help conduct the electricity that brings the creation to life, usually in the form of a lightning bolt. Mary's version has no bolts, and there's no mention of the creation being given life by electricity. In fact, the only mention of lightning is when talking about Victor's father, who is said to have been the one to do the old Ben Franklin key in a kite experiment. That being said, Mary openly states she was inspired by galvanism, which makes the creature being given life by electricity a nice touch, in my opinion. We also need to cover the controversy about who really wrote Frankenstein. It was first published in 1818, anonymously, with a quote from Paradise Lost on the cover. There was a going theory around that time that the work was written by Percy Shelley, because he was credited with writing the preface, and the book was dedicated to William Godwin, who Percy admired. In 1821, the second edition was published and included Mary's name as the author. Before we talk about this controversy, let's cover the indisputable facts. Mary had the idea, Percy wrote the preface, and edited the work. Now to the controversy. Some literary scholars throughout the years have argued that Percy's edits were so intensive that he deserves at least co-writing credit. More modern examinations of notebooks and manuscripts have concluded that the edits Percy made were no more than what a typical editor would do today. I tend to side with the idea that Percy's edits were just edits, and Mary deserves full credit for the work. The previous desire to minimize what Mary did and enhance what Percy did were likely fueled by, let's be honest, sexism. People saw an excuse to discredit the work of a woman and give credit to a man. This was likely heightened by Mary being 18 when she started writing it and only being 20 when it was published. Nothing terrifies bigots more than a successful teenage girl. Mary, Percy, their son William, and Claire Claremont returned to England in September of 1816 and moved to Bath in an attempt to keep Claire's pregnancy secret. While there, Mary and Percy received some letters from Fanny Imlay, Mary's half-sister. On October 9th, Mary and Percy receive another letter from Fanny. William Godwin receives a similar letter. Before we talk about that letter, and what it means. I want to talk about Fanny. Fanny was born to Mary Wollstonecraft and Gilbert Imlay. People believed that Mary and Gilbert were married and Fanny was legitimate. We talked earlier about how Mary and Gilbert's relationship fell apart and how Mary and Fanny came to live with Mary Wollstonecraft's new actual husband, William Godwin, and how Mary died shortly after marriage, giving birth to the girl who would one day be Mary Shelley. Fanny was 3 years old when her mother died. William Godwin and Joseph Johnson, Mary Wollstonecraft's longtime friend and publisher, both contacted Gilbert Imlay, asking if he wanted to raise her. He did not. So William Godwin took her in and changed her name to Fanny Godwin. Mary Wollstonecraft also had two sisters who both offered to take care of their niece Fanny. William, who disliked them, refused their offers multiple times. Godwin clearly loved his children, but he was not often in a great position to take care of them due to his financial troubles. As we also covered earlier, William married Mary Jane Claremont, who had a reputation for favoring her own children over Mary and Fanny. William Godwin also tended to show favoritism, not to Mary Claremont's children, but to his own biological daughter, Mary Godwin. He once wrote, "My own daughter is considerably superior in capacity to the one her mother had before. Fanny, the eldest, is of a quiet, modest, unshowy disposition, somewhat given to indolence, which is her greatest fault, but sober, observing, peculiarly clear and distinct in the faculty of memory, and disposed to exercise her own thoughts and follow her own judgment. Mary, my daughter, is the reverse of her in many particulars. She is singularly bold, somewhat imperious, and active of mind. Her desire for knowledge is great, and her perseverance in everything she undertakes is almost invincible." I know that doesn't sound great, but don't take it as all negative. William Godwin, as far as I can tell, really did love Fanny. He was just never one to hold back his observations. When Fanny was 18, Percy Shelley wrote to William Godwin, asking him to let her come live with him and his wife. Godwin, as we covered earlier, naturally refused. When Percy came to visit the Godwins, Fanny fell quickly in love with him. They would spend many hours discussing various things, especially politics. In 1814, William sent Fanny away to Wales. Historians debate whether this was to separate her from Percy or to try and brighten her spirits. Remember that 1814 also sees Mary, Percy, and Claire run off to Europe. Devastated at the turn of events, William summoned Fanny home. We also know that, at the time, Fanny was deeply affected by the trio running away. I honestly can't tell you if it was over fear for her sister's fates or watching a man she was in love with run away with two of her sisters. Also during this time, William Godwin's son with Mary Jane Claremont, William Godwin the Younger, ran away from home for a few days. The local press would catch wind of all of these events and heavily criticized William Godwin for the chaos of his home. When Percy, Mary, and Claire returned to England and moved out, Fanny was in a tough spot. She was torn between the two warring sides. When she would visit the trio in London, her father would get angry at her. When she refused to move in with the trio or asked Claire to move back home, she was vilified by the trio for siding with her father. She was in a no-win situation. No matter what she did, people she loved would hate her for it. Despite that, she was used by both sides as a kind of middle ground. William Godwin often used her to ask Percy for more money, and she would often warn Percy when creditors were looking for him. Despite all this, both sides still clearly loved Fanny. When Mary Godwin gave birth to her first daughter, the first thing she did was ask for Fanny to come visit. Around this time, Charles Claremont, Mary Jane Claremont's other child from the pre-William times, left for France and cut himself off from the rest of his family. The financial struggles, combined with Mary Claremont becoming increasingly hostile, made for a rough home situation. If you were curious how life in the Godwin house was going. Before Mary, Claire, and Percy left for their adventures at Lake Geneva, Mary and Fanny had a big fight. Despite this, Fanny would continue to write Mary multiple letters, complaining about her life and her rapidly declining state of mind. There is some debate about whether this negative state of mind was due to the Godwin house conditions being unbearable, or whether Fanny suffered from some form of depression. Regardless of the reason, Fanny believed she needed to leave the Godwin home. She constantly asked Mary and Percy to be invited to join them while they were in Europe. When the trio returned to England, Fanny again asked to join them. She was turned down each time, usually by Percy, who was desperately trying to keep Claire's pregnancy by Byron hidden. He was worried that Fanny would tell William and the story would get out, harming everyone's reputations. So, on October 9th, 1816, left with no escape in sight, Fanny Imlay, age 22, put on her best clothes, including some garments belonging to her late mother, and a watch Mary and Percy had sent her, and headed to an inn in Swansea. She sent a letter to Mary and a letter to William Godwin, which alarmed them both so much they rushed to try and find her. Fanny's body was discovered the next day. She had committed suicide by taking a fatal amount of laudanum, the same way her mother, Mary Wollstonecraft, had tried to all those years ago. She left a brief, unfinished note, saying, "I have long determined that the best thing I could do was to put an end to the existence of a being whose birth was unfortunate and whose life has only been a series of pain to those persons who have hurt their health in endeavoring to promote her welfare. Perhaps to hear of my death will give you pain, but you will soon have the blessing of forgetting that such a creature ever existed as..." And it ends there. Fanny was declared simply dead, instead of being declared dead by suicide, which would have hurt the reputation of the surviving parties. She was likely buried in a pauper's grave, and Mary, Percy, and William did their best to cover up her death. A few months later, on the 10th of December, Percy's wife Harriet drowned herself in a lake. I don't know how to describe how I feel about two suicides happening a few months apart that mirror the two suicide attempts of Mary Wollstonecraft, a woman who had tremendous influence over all involved. Remember that Mary had first planned suicide by laudanum and then had jumped into the Thames to drown herself. It feels strangely poetic. At the same time, it feels wrong to call the deaths of two people poetic. Once Harriet is dead, Percy Shelley immediately starts trying to get custody of the two children he had with Harriet. Harriet's family immediately starts trying to prevent that from happening. Mary fully supported Percy's attempts to get his children. In fact, when Percy was advised that he might have a better case if he was married, the couple quickly agreed. They were married December 30th, 1816, 20 days after the death of Harriet. Mary was 19 at the time. William and Mary Jane Claremont both attended the marriage, officially ending the rift. The rift may have ended earlier, as William had written the Shelleys a letter shortly after Fanny's death, breaking his no-contact policy with the couple. And I know it feels like Mary and Percy have been through a lifetime of events since they ran off for Europe after declaring their love. I mean, on a meta note, it's taken me roughly 17 pages to get through it. But remember, they ran off in 1814. They got married at the end of 1816. That means it's only been a little over 2 years. On January 12th of 1817, Claire Claremont gives birth to her daughter. She called her Alba Byron. In other children-related news, in March of that year, the courts deem Percy Shelley morally unfit to have custody over his children with Harriet. After this, Mary, Percy, their son William, as well as Claire and Alba, move to Marlowe. While there, they make friends with critic Leigh Hunt and his wife, Mary Ann. In Marlowe, Mary finishes writing Frankenstein in the summer of 1817. Mary also gives birth to their third child, Clara Shelley, in September. Mary also edited the journals from the 1814 trip to Europe, along with Percy Shelley's poem Mount Blanc, into History of a 6 Weeks Tour, which was published in November of that year. Throughout 1817, Percy Shelley was still constantly dodging creditors. The family also had bouts of poor health and were in constant fear of their children being taken away, especially after Percy was deemed morally unfit to claim his children from his first marriage. So, after anonymously publishing Frankenstein in January of 1818, Mary, Percy, and their two children decide to leave England for good. Their plan is to live in Italy. Claire and Alba also come with them. The first thing the group does when arriving in Italy is hand Alba over to Lord Byron. Despite there being some discussion of Mary and Percy adopting the child into their family, there was a concern that the public would assume the child was Percy and Claire's. So they handed the girl off to Lord Byron, who agreed with a few provisions. Number one, the child would be known as Allegra instead of Alba. Number two, Claire would no longer be able to see the girl. And number three, the girl's last name would be Byron with an I instead of a Y. Lord Byron wanted to distinguish her from his legitimate daughter, who you may know as Ada Lovelace, one of the first computer programmers. Claire agrees to one and two, but insists that the child keep her Y. Mary, Percy, and Claire then leave Byron and begin traveling through Italy. The time between 1818 and 1822 is a whirlwind. It is one of the most productive times for both Mary and Percy. It is also marred by a series of joys and tragedies. Instead of sorting it out chronologically, I'd like to cover the events of these 4 years all at once. Firstly, on the creative front, Percy Shelley writes poem after poem. His output from these years is probably the greatest of his life in terms of volume. He writes his most famous poems, Ozymandias and Adonis, in this time period. Mary doesn't just sit back and be idle, though. She authors two novels, Matilda and Valperga. She also starts writing the novel, Valerius, the Reanimated Roman, but never finishes it. The couple combines their efforts to create two plays, Proserpine and Midas. Secondly, on the romantic and friendship front, Percy has relations with Sophia Stacy, Emilia Viviani, and Jane Williams. These relationships may have been platonic, or they may have been more. We're not really sure. Mary forms close relationships with Greek revolutionary Prince Alexandros, as well as Edward and Jane Williams. Again, we have no evidence of these relationships being anything more than platonic, but they might have been. Mary and Percy were constantly making friends in Italy, especially since a large number of English-speaking people had come to Italy to escape England. On to the final chunk of these years I'd like to cover. I'm going to call this chunk Family and Health. Clara Shelley would die in September of 1818, and William would die in January of 1819. Despite coming to Italy to get healthier, the Shelleys lose both of their children in the span of 5 months. Mary Shelley fell into deep bouts of depression after the loss of each of her children. She stopped writing Valerius, the Reanimated Roman, after William's death. And to be clear, Mary Shelley has made it very clear in her journals that she just wants a child with Percy Shelley. She loves him and just wants a kid with him. It's destroying her that she's lost three children of theirs. In 1820, Percy is accused by Paolo and Elise Foggi, former servants of Percy's, of registering a child in early 1819. Alana Adelaide Shelley is registered as the daughter of Mary and Percy. The only thing we're 100% sure of about Alana is that she is for sure not Mary's biological daughter. There are a few prevailing theories. One, Percy adopted the girl to try to cheer up Mary, who had fallen into a deep depression after the death of William. Two, Alana is the daughter of Percy and Elise Foggi. Three, Alana is the daughter of Lord Byron and Elise Foggi, and Percy was just trying to make things right. Four, Alana is the daughter of Percy Shelley and Claire Claremont. Mary dismisses this one in her journal, believing that she would have known if Claire was pregnant. 5. Alana is the daughter of Percy Shelley and, insert woman here. Mary and Percy had a pretty open relationship, and Percy Shelley had a well-known reputation as a womanizer. Regardless of the truth, Alana died in 1820, less than 2 years after her birth. This long trend of child deaths may have you questioning how Allegra Byron, daughter of Claire and Lord Byron, is doing. By 1822, she had been living in a convent for 13 months. Claire and the Shelleys did not approve, as they had been promised that the child would stay with Byron. They also disapproved of the child getting a Roman Catholic education. Claire wrote to Byron about her frequently. She even offered to take the child back with her, pointing out that convents were not the healthiest places. Lord Byron refused, citing the fact that living with the Shelleys wasn't the healthiest place, considering the fact that all their children had died. In April of 1822, Alana spiked a high fever, likely from typhus, and would pass away at the age of 5. Byron would later say of Allegra, "Let the object of affection be snatched away by death, and how is all the pain ever afflicted upon them avenged? The same imagination that led us to slight or overlook their sufferings, now that they are forever lost to us, magnifies their estimable qualities. How did I feel this when my daughter Allegra died? While she lived, her existence never seemed necessary to my happiness. But no sooner did I lose her than it appeared to me as if I could not live without her." I have one final child to cover before we jump back to our chronological journey. Percy Florence Shelley, born in November of 1818. And I know what you're thinking. Another child, another heartbreak. Percy Florence Shelley will indeed die. In 1889, at the age of 70, Percy Florence Shelley will live a full life. And I'm sorry for the spoilers, but I think we could all use some good news right now. This last section has been a little grim, and we're not really out of the woods yet. We return to our chronological quest in the summer of 1822. Mary Shelley is now 24 and pregnant again. Mary, Percy, and Claire move to a place called Villa Magni, which I've also seen called Casa Magni, located near San Terenzo. They are joined by Edward and Jane Williams, their close friends. Mary Shelley did not like Villa Magni, finding it cramped and isolated. Mary Shelley's time in Villa Magni would only get worse when on June 16th she suffered a miscarriage. This miscarriage was nearly fatal, as Mary was losing a lot of blood. Percy Shelley decided, as a last-ditch effort, to put Mary into an ice bath while they waited for the doctor to get to their isolated home. When the doctor arrived, he commended Percy on his choice, believing that the ice bath had likely saved Mary's life. Mary sunk into another bout of deep depression after losing another child and nearly dying. Percy, for lack of a better word, found this to be a huge bummer. So he would frequently leave Mary alone so he could go spend time with Jane Williams. Percy would write most of his poetry about Jane while he was at Villa Magni. The whole Villa Magni leg of the Shelley's trip has not gone well so far. But it did offer something, a chance to sail. Percy Shelley loved to sail. Percy had commissioned Captain Daniel Roberts and Edward Trelawney to design and build him a boat, and by the 1st of July, 1822, the schooner Don Juan was ready to sail. Percy Shelley, Edward Williams, and Captain Daniel Roberts sailed down to Livorno. Mary Shelley did not go with them, likely because she was still recovering from her miscarriage. While in Livorno, Percy met with Lord Byron and Leigh Hunt. They were debating starting up a new magazine together called The Liberal. A few days later, Percy and Edward Williams leave Livorno with their boatboy Charles Vivian, intending to return home. A letter from Leigh Hunt for Percy Shelley arrives at Villa Magni before Percy does. In the letter, Hunt asked Percy to write to him when he made it home, since there were rumors of foul weather. Basically, a text-me-when-you-get-home kind of letter. Mary Shelley and Jane Williams read the letter and immediately leave Villa Magni in search of their husbands. 10 days after the foul weather Hunt had heard about, three bodies washed up roughly halfway between Livorno and Villa Magni. The bodies were identified as Percy, Edward, and their boat boy. Percy Shelley was cremated on the beach where he was found. Mary Shelley is devastated by this. They had come to Italy to lead happy, healthy lives. Now her husband was dead. All but one of her children were dead. And she was still recovering from her recent miscarriage. Mary Shelley would spend the next year recovering in Genoa with Leigh Hunt and his family, where she maintained connections with the group of friends she and Percy had made in Italy, including Lord Byron. And while she's there, Mary makes a decision. She decides to live on for her son. She also decides she wants to make a living as a writer. This was a relatively new concept. Before this time, being a writer wasn't really a job. Traditionally, if you wanted to be a writer, you had to already be rich, work a separate job to pay the bills, or have a rich patron. But with the explosion of literacy caused by the invention and popularization of the printing press, the idea of writing as a career started to become viable. Mary Shelley is not the first person to try this, she's not even the first woman, but she is one of the first. And given how unsuccessful her father had been at making a living by writing and publishing, as evidenced by his constant financial troubles, it was probably a terrifying choice. However, Mary would receive a boost of encouragement from her father in February of 1823. "Do not, I entreat you, be cast down about your worldly circumstances. You certainly contain within yourself the means of subsistence. Your talents are truly extraordinary. Frankenstein is universally known, and, though it can never be a book for vulgar reading, is everywhere respected. It is the most wonderful book to have been written at 20 years of age that I ever heard of. You are now 25, and most fortunately, you have pursued a course of reading and cultivated your mind in the manner most admirably adapted to make you a great and successful author. If you cannot be independent, who should be? Your talents, as far as I can at present discern, are turned for the writing of fictitious adventures." So, spurred on by her father and love for her son, Mary Shelley picks herself up and moves back to England in July of 1823. When she returned to England, she worked out a deal with Sir Timothy Shelley, her father-in-law. Sir Timothy's first deal was that Mary would give her son over to a guardian, and Sir Timothy would financially support the child.
Mary, who so desperately wanted a child with Percy Shelley and had lost every other child they had had, instantly turns it down. Eventually, they settled on an allowance of £100 a year, which Mary would have to pay back when her son inherited his part of the estate. This is roughly the equivalent of £15,000 today. Not a lot of money, but it's something. With that settled, Mary began her work. She began to edit and publish Percy's unfinished poems, as well as start work on some of her own projects. She desperately wanted to write and publish a biography of Percy Shelley, but Sir Timothy expressly forbade this, threatening to cut her off if she published such a thing. Given how much damage William Godwin's biography had done to Mary Wollstonecraft's reputation, you can almost see where Sir Timothy is coming from. The Godwins didn't have a great track record with biographies of their spouses. In 1824, Lord Byron was in Greece. He had gone to join the Greeks in their fight for independence from the Ottoman Empire. He offered the Greeks significant financial support and was willing to go into battle, although I was unable to find any definitive proof he ever actually saw combat. In April of that year, while planning an attack, Byron contracted a fever and, possibly due to the treatment he was given, passed away on the 19th. And yet another member of Mary Shelley's circle of friends falls. However, Lord Byron's death is a rallying point in the Greek War of Independence. The death of a prominent figure like Byron also draws significant international sympathy for the Greek cause, eventually leading to independence for Greece. Shortly after Lord Byron's death, Mary moves to Kentish Town to be closer to her friend, Jane Williams. Percy and Byron's deaths inspired Mary to start writing her novel, The Last Man. The Last Man is interesting to me. It's essentially a story about loss and loneliness. Plot-wise, it's about a pandemic of bubonic plague that rapidly spreads throughout the world, killing almost everyone. Its main characters are pretty much just Percy Shelley, Mary Shelley, and Lord Byron under different names. The novel ends with Lionel Verney, the Mary Shelley character, being the last human on Earth. As someone who had seen as much loss as Mary Shelley had, she probably felt a little like the last human on Earth. The Last Man is a groundbreaking work, being arguably the first ever piece of dystopian fiction, as well as one of the first post-apocalyptic novels. Despite this, it was ripped apart by contemporary critics. They hated how bleak it was and felt that the theme of lastness had been overdone at this time. Despite this, Mary was quite proud of it. The book only saw a few publishings, then was completely forgotten until the 1900s, where it reemerged. It gained even more prominence recently during the COVID-19 pandemic, where isolation and loneliness from a disease that was spreading around the world was all of a sudden much more relevant. One of the more impressive things is that Mary Shelley foresaw that politics would take center stage in the event of a global pandemic. Eileen Hunt, a professor at the University of Notre Dame who has done significant research into Mary Shelley and is infinitely more qualified than I am to talk about this, wrote a very good article for the New York Times. Around this time, Mary meets actor John Howard Payne and his friend, Washington Irving. John Payne quickly fell in love with Mary and proposed to her in 1826. At this time, Mary would have been around 29. Mary was flattered, but she turned him down. Payne asked William Irving to propose instead. It's possible that this proposal would have been better received by Mary, but it never came for one reason or another. 1826 also saw the death of Percy Shelley's son with his first wife, making Percy Florence Shelley the heir to the Shelley estate. Sir Timothy raised the allowance given to Mary and her son to £250. In 1827, Mary worked with a group of friends to help Isabel Robinson and Mary Diana Dodds, known as either David Lindsay or Walter Sholto Douglas, moved to France to live as husband and wife,
She would visit the pair in 1828. In fact, it's thanks in large part to a study of Mary Shelley's letters that we know that Walter Sholto Douglas, who wrote under the pseudonym David Lindsley, was born Mary Dodds. There's even fairly strong evidence that Walter Douglas was more than just a cover identity used to hide her femininity and preference for women. Walter Douglas acted like a man in public and in private, suggesting that he was what we would call trans today. As you may have noticed, we're starting to enter Mary Shelley's slow period. Gone are the days when I had to spend 17 pages describing 2 years. Now, Mary's main focuses are on the care of her son, Percy Florence Shelley, and establishing and fostering the reputation of her late husband, Percy Bysshe Shelley. She also just spends a lot of time writing, which is good for her output, but doesn't give me a lot to cover. At some point in 1828, Mary Shelley is approached romantically by Prosper Mérimée, a French writer. We don't know much about their courtship other than it was unsuccessful. Also around this time, Edward Trelawney returns to England. Edward, as you may remember, was one of the men who helped build Percy's boat. The two had often joked in their letters about marrying each other, but when he returns to England, it doesn't happen. In 1830, Mary finishes her next novel, The Fortunes of Perkin Warbeck. She also works with a publisher to sell a new version of Frankenstein. She writes a new introduction, which includes biographical information. This is the version I quoted from earlier. In 1832, Percy Florence Shelley starts attending public school, which was something his father, Percy Bysshe Shelley, wanted for his children. Mary and her son moved to Harrow-on-the-Hill so that Percy could attend Harrow School, a public school she approved of. In 1835, she finishes her next novel, Lodore. Even if you came into this podcast with knowledge of Mary Shelley, I bet you didn't know she'd written this many novels. In 1835, she also starts working on Lives of the Most Eminent Literary and Scientific Men. This was a collection of biographies about prominent men in literature and science put together by Dionysius Lardner. Various editions covered men from Italy, Spain, Portugal, and France. Of the 10 total volumes, Mary contributed to at least 5 of them. It was here that Mary really shined. She proved through these biographies that she had the ability to not only do research and be knowledgeable in multiple languages, but she also proved herself to be a very good biographer. And I know earlier, to prove William Godwin was a good writer, I used a review by notable poet Edgar Allan Poe. This time, I'm going to prove Mary Shelley was a good writer by using a review by notable poet Edgar Allan Poe. This is from his 1841 review of the Lives of Eminent Literary and Scientific Men of Italy. We have no clue to the names of the respective writers, but the biographies are, without exception, well written. Although at times their brevity is annoying. As a whole, the work is not only interesting, but of value. And hey, if the worst thing a reviewer has to say about something you've written is, it was too short, you're doing pretty good. Always leave them wanting more. Mary also used these biographies to promote women's equality. She would criticize patriarchal things like primogeniture, which is inheritance going to the eldest son, while praising things like the Renaissance's focus on female education. In 1836, William Godwin passes away at the age of 80. His final wish is for Mary Shelley to assemble his letters and write a biography of him, similar to what he did for his late wife all those years ago. Mary put a significant amount of effort into this, but she ultimately abandons the project 2 years later. In 1837, she finishes her next novel, Faulkner. Percy Florence Shelley also starts at Trinity College, Cambridge, in 1837. In 1838, Mary works with publisher Edward Moxon to publish the collected works of Percy Shelley. Mary had spent a lot of time working on making her late husband well-known, by doing things like quoting him in her own writings to increase his notoriety. So she was the natural choice to edit this collection. Due to Sir Timothy's outright ban of any biographies of Percy Bysshe Shelley from Mary, they couldn't include a biography in the collection. Mary, however, found a loophole. She didn't include a biography, but she included extensive notes on each poem. In these notes, it only made sense to include biographical information. So, Mary was able to tell the story of Percy's life, despite not writing a biography. In 1839, Mary, who had been no stranger to illness throughout her life, begins to suffer headaches and bouts of paralysis. This makes it hard for her to focus on reading and writing. Between 1840 and 1843, Mary and her son take two trips through the European continent. The trips, especially while in Italy, are bittersweet for Mary. She has very fond memories of her friends and the creative work she did while in Italy, but it's also where she lost her husband and children. She records these journeys in Rambles in Germany and Italy, which is published in 1844. This travelogue would be the final thing Mary Shelley ever published. Also in 1844, Sir Timothy Shelley finally dies at the age of 90, giving Mary and her son financial stability for the first time in their lives. In 1848, Percy Florence Shelley marries Jane Gibson St. John. By all accounts, Percy and Jane are very happily married, and Mary approves of the marriage. Mary would continue to live with her son and his wife for the rest of her life, which is unfortunately not long. She would die in 1851 at the age of 53. Her doctor believed it was due to a brain tumor. Mary requested her son bury her with her parents at St. Pancras, which was also where she used to sneak away to meet with Percy all those years ago. Percy Florence Shelley and his wife Jane both disapprove of St. Pancras. So to compromise, they move William Godwin and Mary Wollstonecraft to St. Peter's Church in Bournemouth and bury Mary there with them. When Percy and Jane open Mary's desk, they supposedly find locks of her children's hair, one of the joint journals she had with her husband, and Percy Shelley's heart and ashes wrapped in a copy of Adonis. If this is true, I can't imagine what kind of condition his heart would have been. Remember, they dug his body out of a river, and he'd been dead for almost 30 years at this point. So that's Mary Shelley. She believed in free and open love, but we only really know of one man she was ever intimate with. She desperately wanted to have many, many children, yet only one would survive. She was a literary pioneer in the science fiction, post-apocalypse, and dystopian genres. She was born to radical parents and lived a radical life. In terms of a legacy, she was the child of two figures well known in history. She and her husband are also pretty well known. So what happened to her son? Did he go on to continue the line of well-remembered geniuses? Not really. He lived a long life working with the law. A nice change of pace from his father, who spent his life narrowly avoiding being thrown into a debtor's prison. He inherited his father's love of boating, as he was an avid yachter. He also inherited his mother's love of drama, frequently attending the theater. History remembers him as the son of Mary and Percy, not based on anything he did, which is fine. History forgets most of us. And you have to remember that Mary Shelley is the exception. Children of geniuses don't often exhibit their parents' aptitudes. So I've now told you the story of Mary Shelley. Equally fascinating to me is the story of the story of Mary Shelley. For most of the time between her death and now, she was only really remembered as the author of Frankenstein and the wife of Percy Shelley. And some people didn't even believe she wrote Frankenstein. That all changed in the last few decades, thanks mainly to the work of feminists. The growing interest in the history of female authors caused people to re-examine Mary Shelley as more than just a wife and a one-hit wonder. What we know about Mary Shelley now is radically different from what we knew of Mary Shelley even 50 years ago. And I, for one, can't wait to see what we know 50 years from now. So before we end, I'd like to answer a question. Why do I care so much about Mary Shelley? Well, to talk about that, we've got to talk about me. I've never been good at planning for the future or having goals. My brain has always been a survive the now, let the future me deal with the consequences kind of brain. In high school, when asked what I wanted to be when I grew up, I always said a hobo, as that didn't really seem to require much future planning. But when we covered Mary Shelley in high school, we also covered the infamous summer at Villa Diodati, where three of the greatest literary minds of their generation, and a few of their friends and relatives, spent a summer in a house by the beach, hanging out, telling German ghost stories, and having writing contests between them. And as I thought about and imagined that summer, I felt something I've never felt before. For the first time in my life, I wanted to be something. I wanted to be Mary Shelley. A great writer casually hanging out with other great writers and producing genre-altering works based off friendly writing contests. That being said, I kept saying I wanted to be a hobo. But that's why I care about Mary Shelley. She was the first person to offer a young me an aspiration. And for the record, I missed the mark by quite a bit. I don't really consider myself a writer. Not anymore. I don't have a close net of friends that are era-defining minds. I've never even spent a summer by the lake telling ghost stories. I did learn a bit of German, though, so I'll give myself partial credit. Regardless of how my life has turned out, I'm eternally grateful to the woman who gave my life hope. Mary Shelley is my hero. If you've made it all the way to the end, I want to thank you for listening. If you have questions, comments, concerns, or suggestions for a storyteller you'd like me to cover, feel free to reach out on Twitter at storyofstorytlr. Or, if you've abandoned Twitter, which is completely reasonable, feel free to email me at storyofthestorytellers@gmail.com. Finally, to steal a quote from a pair of goofs, soupy twists.